Hey everyone, it's Dan, your host for Eventually Super Train, the short-lived TV show podcast covering short-lived TV shows one episode at a time. Yay! Thank you so much for listening. Episode 48, and we are back on track. We are kicking butt. This is going to be fun. You're going to enjoy this. We're starting off today with episode 16 of The Green Hornet from late 66. I believe the end of December 66. I could be wrong there. Don't quote me on that, because we'll probably mention it in this segment. Kristen Hawes, a.k.a. Kiki Wrights, is back. Hooray! Yay! And it is, what, The Hornet and the Firefly, which is cool. What else? Oh, Mitchell Hadley from It's About TV and myself will be discussing the fourth episode of Bourbon Street Beat. We are in October 59, Woman in the River. A lot of fun guest stars in this one. And my sweet wife Madeline and I are discussing episode 14 of Ellery Queen Mysteries, The Adventure of the Eccentric Engineer, from January of 76. So we are in 59, 66, and 76. I think it's fun. I think you're going to like it. Let's dive right in. Mr. Bill Dozier.
Another challenge for the Green Hornet, his aide Cato, and their rolling arsenal, the Black Beauty. On police records, a wanted criminal, the Green Hornet is really Britt Reed, owner-publisher of the Daily Sentinel, his dual identity known only to his secretary and to the district attorney. And now, to protect the rights and lives of decent citizens, rides the Green Hornet.
Episode 16, everyone. We're on episode 16 of The Green Hornet. Can you believe it? I mean, I feel like it's. They say time flies, and sometimes you're doing podcasts, it seems like time goes on forever. These things take a lot of work every once in a while. But for somebody, 16 episodes into The Green Hornet, this is awesome. We are on December 30th, 1966, the last of the December episodes, The Hornet and the Firefly. And I am here with my good friend, the wonderful Kiki Wrights, a.k.a. Kristen Hawes. How are you, Kristen?
I'm excited to be here, Dan. How are you?
I'm feeling good. I feel like we haven't talked in a long time. I don't know why that is.
I don't know.
I just want to say, and I'm not going to qualify it, really. I just want to apologize to you and leave it at that.
Yeah, that's quite all right. I understand.
Okay. That's where I'm leaving it, folks. So we are, Hornet and the Firefly. Here we go. This one is written by William L. Stewart, directed by Alan Reisner. And Kristen, please give us a little breakdown.
All right. Green Hornet and Cato are rolling out at 3 minutes till midnight. Hornet calls Scanlan in his office to let him know that he's standing by, and Scanlan tells him to hold on while he watches a teletype machine type away. At midnight, an unseen man makes a phone call, and the incessant ringing finally sets off a bomb. News of the explosion comes across the teletype, which Scanlan relays to Hornet. The warehouse that's been bombed is an inferno, and Hornet lets Scanlan know that they covered all the exits, but there's no sign of the firebug. Scanlan says there's been 12 injuries, two serious, and the commissioner is having a meeting about these fires tomorrow, and he invites Hornet to show up as Britt Reed. At the meeting, the commissioner informs everyone that at midnight for the past 7 nights, an arsonist has struck somewhere in the city, and he's open to suggestions on capturing him. Our wonderful Mike Axford suggests that the commissioner use the help of Ben Wade, a one-eyed former arson investigator.
Commissioner Dolan, you know Ben Wade. He was retired from service a few months ago because of his injury. But there isn't a man in this town knows more about arson, or determining the methods of its use, or preventing it, than Ben Wade.
We know all about Mr. Wade. Good to see you, Ben. Thank you, Commissioner. If I can help, I'd like to. It's already been suggested. When we realized the extent of our problem, your name came up. Thank you, sir. But it was rejected. The job you held cost you the sight of one eye. We can't possibly risk the loss of the other.
But, Commissioner, that would be my risk, not yours.
I'm sorry, Ben. The decision's reluctant, but it's firm. You and I know it's against department policy.
At the Sentinel, Gary Owens informs the public and us about the arsonist. Casey asks why the arsonist hasn't made any demands, and Britt theorizes that he might just enjoy causing panic. Mike comes in and suggests that the Sentinel hire Ben Wade to help investigate the fires. Maybe he can figure out how the fires are starting, and they can warn possible targets. Britt says he'll consider it. As Hornet and Kato roll out to protect the city, a man in a hot suit shows up at a warehouse and somehow sneaks past the guard. While he sets up things inside, Green Hornet calls Scanlan 20 minutes before midnight, and Scanlan is feeling pretty good about the helicopter coverage preventing another fire. Hot suit man, though, has different ideas. He sets his fire. This smoke report comes across the teletype, which Scanlan relays to Green Hornet. Meanwhile, the security guard finally realizes that everything is on fire, calls it in, and rushes into the burning warehouse for reasons. Hornet and Kato pull up just as Hot Suit Man comes out. Kato takes him down as Green Hornet rushes inside and saves the security guard. As Kato is watching the door, Hot Suit Man cheap shots in and takes off. Green Hornet comes out with a security guard who recognizes them and runs off. Green Hornet and Kato leave as the fire brigade arrives. Hot Suit Man arrives home wearing an overcoat because that's subtle. And surprise, it's our former arson investigator, Ben Wade. And he gets a surprise, too, as Mike is waiting for him.
Hello, Ben. Crawling in kind of late, aren't you? And in a hot suit.
How did you get in here?
So you're the firebug.
Just because I'm wearing a hot suit, that doesn't prove anything.
No. But added to these locations and dates, it does. Every fire, including the one tonight.
I heard that on the radio. I wrote it down. I'm trying to establish a pattern.
Set one, you mean? I heard the fire report on my police radio just as I got here, and you haven't been home for hours. I was trying to get you on the phone to give you what I thought was good news. Ben, why are you doing this?
Don't you know? Forced retirement for a man who dedicated himself to the city. Lost an eye for it.
Man, they offered you another job.
Sure. Sitting behind a desk, punching holes in paper. Answering the phone when people who call up are sick.
Are they any sicker than you?
Mike, how would you be? For 3 months, I've been cooped up in this building, staring at four walls. I've turned into a cripple. Mentally, not physically.
You did it to yourself. Ben, I've known you too long.
You only think you know me. Nobody knows me. I'm just beginning to know myself. And I'm not going to settle for the pasture. Not yet.
So you figured to start a few fires and be needed and called back.
Look at this! Scrapbook. Look at it. Lieutenant Ben Wade, Sol shipboard fire. Lieutenant Wade captures arson ring single-handed.
It's the headlines you miss. You're about to make the biggest headline yet.
The next morning, Britt and Casey ask where... Or Britt asks Casey where Mike is, but no one has seen him. Ben claims Mike didn't come to his house, and the people at Mike's apartment building say he hasn't been home. Britt goes to talk to Ben, who repeats his story, and then says that Mike called him from his apartment that morning. Britt is suspicious, but offers Ben the Sentinel job, which a bound and gagged Mike overhears in the next room. Britt lays out his suspicions to Scanlan, who can't believe it because Ben is one of Mike's oldest friends. Britt says that Mike could have easily stumbled upon something. Ben knows a lot about arson and lied to Britt about Mike calling. At the Sentinel, Britt gives Ben his first assignment.
Well, I filled out all the forms. I belong to you now.
Good. I have your first assignment.
You don't waste any time, do you?
There's none to waste. A replacement shipment of medical supplies is arriving this afternoon.
I hope you're sneaking them in.
We are. Top secret. If we lose it, the situation becomes critical. That Green Hornet is tricky. We have to be ready.
I got you. Where are you storing it?
The Sentinel has a warehouse at the harbor. Shipment is camouflaged as newsprint, ink, paper.
Good idea.
I want you to go down and check out the warehouse. Make certain there are no incendiaries.
What's to prevent someone from planting them tonight?
We have the police surrounding the place. No one in or out.
Mr. Reed, you don't want to just protect this shipment. You'd like to catch the Green Hornet, too, wouldn't you?
Of course.
Well, then pull the police out. Let me handle this alone. Don't just scare them away.
Isn't that risky?
So's crossing the street.
Ben gets Mike ready to go to the warehouse. He tells Mike that this will be his greatest arson bust ever. He'll catch and kill the firebug, and the firebug will be Mike. Ben and Mike get to the warehouse. Green Hornet and Kato show up. It's about to get hot in here. But before it gets all explosive, I gotta ask you, Dan.
Yes.
What did you think of the episode?
You know I love poor Mike episodes so very much. And this is definitely one of those. It's a slightly weird episode, though, because I was going to say for a moment when you revealed that Ben Wade was the firebug, and it's revealed about halfway through the episode, and he's the only other person in the episode who it could be. So I had to kind of argue with myself, is that a big reveal, or is that just sort of the next plot point? You know, because it's not like, you know, like, Hercule Poirot just spent a half an hour describing what happened with eight people over the course of a weekend of someone got murdered and then someone turns out to be the murderer. No, there's only one guy, and it's him. And so I had to sort of deal with the fact that the big reveal is not sort of not fully the point of it. It's about this guy sort of letting Mike down and then putting Mike in danger. And using, I don't know what the heck it is that Ben uses, but in that final scene where he starts a fire, I wrote down fire balloons. I don't know what they are, but it looked like he had a box full of water balloons, but when he threw them, they started fires.
Well, when I saw them, because he was making them on his desk, and I'm like, those look exactly like the smoke bombs we had when I was a kid, except a much bigger version. So that's how I was thinking of them.
All I could think of was all those Boy Scout picnics where you would throw the water balloon and then you'd have to catch it and then you'd take a step back and then you'd throw it and have to catch it. If those are like incendiary devices, think of how much more exciting that would have been, and think how many times my best friend Kostaki Fragiadakis would have caught on fire because he was clumsy.
And how upset his mother would have been, because how many shirts would he have ruined?
Oh my God. And it's just there it goes again. Oh God. Well, they would cover you in that sort of that fire retardant jelly that they cover people in when they do like those full body fire stunts in movies.
And so, yeah, there you go.
So we would all be covered in that. And but I think that the thing about the episode is that I love all the fire in it. Fire is very tricky to do, and to have a show that was probably made as quickly as this show was, and I know some of the fire was stock footage, but quite a bit of it was stunt people within fire. And there's one moment too where the fire, where the firebug sneaks in the hot suit and Kato knocks him out, the Green Hornet like rushes in, not knowing if anyone's in there, and then you just see a shot of him like running through fire. You know, the camera's a little too high up to make it look terribly dangerous, but it's still like, oh my gosh, that stunt person is running through fire, looking for hopefully a security guard. But I like the episode. It's funny. I'm always saying that I think these episodes sometimes are paced perfectly, and sometimes they're paced a little too quickly. This one was paced possibly because they revealed Ben Wade so early on. This one is paced, it feels slightly off to me. Like sort of, and it's the first one I've watched where I thought this one might be a little slow. Even though there are fires, just because after the second fire with the sneaky guy in the hot suit, and we could talk about how sneaky he is in a moment, after that fire, once it's revealed that it's Ben, it's just a question of getting to the final fire. And it seemed like it took a little long to get there. It seemed like it ran out of plot about halfway through, and then it just kind of treaded water until the final scene. Not that I was bored or I disliked it, but I'm so used to them being so quick. This one just felt a little, not unappetizing, but a little, I wasn't as involved with this one as I thought I would be. Not that I disliked it, but you have to, there's always going to be some episodes like this. I thought it was an okay one, and we can go more into it. But what did you think of it?
Now, see, I'm of the mind, I really liked this episode.
Okay.
I did. I liked it because, basically because it's Mike in peril, but it's also Mike having, like, this guy who's, Scanlan says, is one of his oldest friends, basically turning on him. He was going to kill him and frame him for his own headline. That is brutal. That is a brutal, brutal, brutal thing. And I just, to me, I didn't think it was slow. Because you said, you know, after that fire, after the reveal of Ben, I just thought that was, like, building tension, because there's Mike. He's gagged, bound and gagged in the other room, and Britt comes in, and it's like, no, you have to go save him. Save Mike. Poor Mike.
I think that the moment that I really liked when Ben catches Ben like pulls out a gun from inside his hot suit, and I thought, I hope that hot suit really works, because if you're walking through fire and you have a loaded gun like against your chest, oh my god, I hope that, because won't that go off if it gets too hot? Your chest is gone. I don't know.
If it gets hot enough, I mean, you'd think it might ignite the gunpowder in there and cause you a real problem. Though I'm of the mind that too, that, you know, because you see it all the time on TV shows, they stick the gun in their waistband, and I'm just like, no, that's how accidents happen. We don't put our guns there.
And they also like, after people fire guns, they put it in their waistbands. I'm fairly certain that barrel is really hot.
Yes, that barrel is like incredibly hot. Now you just,
I mean,
put it up against your skin and.
You
must have scar tissue there.
I'm gonna say,
you've done it, doing it so many times.
Yes. Oh yeah, that's nice. unless they're using that gel I mentioned earlier around their area when they're just like, I know I'm gonna do this by accident because I think it's cool. So I got gel down there. So I'm okay.
That's good foresight right there.
Yeah. I think at the moment where Mike is trying to talk to Ben and say, like, Ben, come on, you're my friend, I know you. And Ben's like, you don't know me. And it's just like, you see this guy who suddenly, like, has gone completely round the bend and is just like, wow, poor Mike. I mean, he's got some friends. Having said that, I don't love this episode. I do love Mike in it, and I wish he'd get rescued. There's something about it that I'm finding a little off. Maybe I got it wrong about the pacing, but there's something in it that I'm finding a little. Maybe I feel like I should be more invested in it, and I'm not as invested in it as I think I should be because it's Mike, and I don't know why. Maybe I'll never know why. Maybe this is a mystery for the ages why I didn't fully love this episode. But I do love the fact that he's caused a fire at midnight for 7 nights in a row. I mean, that is good arson.
That is good arson. I can barely stay up until midnight 7 nights in a row. And this guy's going out and commit fire. And not only is he setting fires, he's using different tactics for each fire. That's creativity as well.
Yeah, he's really he's like really going for it. Like it's funny. There was a when I heard the name Firebug over and over again, I looked it up because there's a Batman villain named Firebug. But Firebug didn't show up until 1979, and he was a guy who I forget his full story, but it's something like he had like several family members die in several fires that were arson related, and he felt like the police weren't doing what they should do, and so for whatever reason he snapped and started causing fires of his own. And but that was 79. And then every time I hear the word arson, all I can think of is Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit. I don't know if you've seen Curse of the Were-Rabbit.
I don't think I have.
There's a moment in it where everyone's assembled and they're trying to figure out who's been destroying all their gardens. Spoiler, it's the Were-Rabbit. And everyone in this small village are in the local church, and the main police inspector is there. And he says, well, I know what it is. What is it, Inspector? It's a case of arson. Arson? What do you mean? Yeah, somebody arson around. And whenever I hear arson, that's all I think of, is someone arson around. But that's not Ben Wade, though. That's not Ben Wade. What else do you have on this one?
There are a couple of ones that I just think are a little bit... they're kind of silly in my head because, first of all, when you have the man in the hot suit sneaking past this worthless security guard who runs into a burning building for why?
Yes.
Did he think that there might be a fire extinguisher in there, and he's just like, it's a small fire, I can get it. Was he thinking this? What was he thinking? I don't think he was.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's really good. I mean, I could you imagine a security guard saying, whoa, I'm going to run into the burning building?
I mean, no, there's nothing worth saving. There's nobody in there.
Yes.
There's no other humans. It's just like, I'm going to call this in and eat my lunch because there's really nothing to guard now. And I did a bad job of it anyway. Because Ben sneaks past in this hot suit, and I'm like, I just, when I look at the hot suit, because it's this bright silver suit, and all I can think of is Jiffy Pop wrappers, and I'm thinking, that has to make noise. How do you not hear this guy basically ducking down and duck walking past you in your little security guard booth?
He's doing like the sneak, sneak, sneak. Sneak, I'm a little wabbit sneaking around. Kind of, and it's tricky because, as with all these episodes, it's the day for night is, you know, like the better we're seeing these episodes, the day for night is not being helped. And there's a lot of day. I mean, the episode begins with, what time do you have, Kato? And from the opening shot, I thought, 3 in the afternoon? 3 to midnight. Really? Okay. Wow. Maybe some captions would help. And then the thing is that it's supposed to be midnight again when the guy's in the hot suit. And you literally, it's like, it's in a back lot. So, like, the warehouse he's kind of going in is sort of back lot-y. And he's kind of hiding on the side of a little building near it. But it's like, it literally looks like it's noon. And there's just this guy in this bright silver suit sneaking along. Sneak, sneak, sneak. Sneak, sneak, sneak. And it's like, oh. Well, I guess it works. I guess everyone in this town has some sort of night blindness or something like that. But...
And then he comes home, and all he does is put an overcoat over this hot suit. Yeah. And I'm like, because that's subtle. Like, you're in disguise there, sir.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's not like you stayed somewhere overnight and you came home in your PJs and threw a coat over it or something like that. You know, this is a hot suit. You know,
you're not running out of the store.
Yeah, you know, you might be able to fool me with your pajama bottoms and a coat, but that's like an arson squad hot suit. Yeah, I got it. What else? I'm looking at my notes here, and it's too bad. With the I will say this, I do have the note here. Keep an eye on that guy, Kato, because the firebug runs out of the building. Kato wallops him. The guy's on the ground, and Green Hornet rushes into the fire, and Kato like just turns his back to the guy, and I thought, Kato, how much smoke have you taken in right here? Because you should keep an eye on that guy. And in fact, the firebug leaps up and knocks over Kato and takes off running. I thought, oh gosh, and I thought that would have been an interesting twist too if they caught him halfway through or something like that, and maybe he said like, I've got another bomb set off somewhere or something like that. The second half was trying to like find where the bomb was or something. But it just ends up they knock out the guy and then turn their back on him and he runs away, which dramatically isn't the best, especially when Bruce Lee is the guy doing it.
Yeah, it's like Kato got a little overconfident. Yeah, like, I have clobbered you. You will stay down.
Maybe he punched him in the gun or something. You know, it's like shooting someone that's got a Bible in their pocket or something.
Yeah, I think the hot suit absorbed some of the heat from
that from would be great. They're made by NASA. You never know. They were crazy.
They can take re-entry. They can take a Kato punch.
Yes, I do like that. Mike does figure out what is going on. He figures out that I like that.
Yeah, and then he shows up to Ben's house, who, again, he just walks in, so nobody locks their doors there.
Yes, yeah.
Because Mike's just waiting for him. And then he's like, and then Ben has the audacity, when Mike points out that he's wearing a hot suit, he says, because I wrote this down, just because I'm wearing a hot suit doesn't mean anything. Excuse me, sir. Who are you trying to fool? Perhaps if this were like 1977 and you were going to Studio 54, I might believe you. But no, this is 1966, sir.
Yeah. If you're dressed like John Travolta from Saturday Night Fever and I catch you leaving the house, don't tell me you're going to do some plumbing. I know exactly where you're going.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, he tries. I mean, it's funny because I like the way I didn't write all of it down here, but they have that big meeting, and Mike stands up and says, I think I have a solution. And he goes to the door, opens the door, and he doesn't say it, but I said it both times I watched this episode. I think I have the solution. It's a guy with an eye patch. And everyone's like, we hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, that was kind of my reaction too. I'm like, it's a guy with one eye. How is this solving your problem?
I do like the commissioner's thing too, where he says the reason why we're not going to let you do it is you lost one eye. We're not going to be responsible for you possibly losing another. And then that's, hey, commish, I understand. You know,
yeah.
That's,
but that, now that, I have questions because he's an arson investigator. How did he lose his eye?
Yeah.
Like what was happening that he lost one eye, and how is it that it happens so frequently, or it must happen so frequently, that you're afraid he might lose the other one
yes.
the same way? I'm
yes.
concerned.
I'd love it if they cut to, we talked with our other arson investigators, and they just show a series of people with eye patches on different eyes. That would be like, now we're in like Police Squad or something like that.
Yes. Well, I'm already a little concerned because the commissioner is like, you know, we don't know how to catch this guy. I'm open to suggestions. What?
I do. I mean, the commissioner he's the most honest commissioner I've ever seen. For the past 7 nights at midnight, these horrible fires have been set, and we expect them to continue going on. I have to be honest. I have no idea what to do. Well, you know, I appreciate your honesty, sir. I appreciate your honesty.
And now you're crowdsourcing this room full of suits, including the media, including the press.
Yes.
On what to do. I feel like this is inefficient.
Yeah. and I would love it. I just imagine like a scene where it was the screen went all wibbly wobbly, and then they showed like Ben Wade and someone else sitting there discussing like a crime and say, well, I think that the incendiary was set with this. Oh, Ben, do you want some coffee? Yes, please. How many sugars? Just like a little bit of sugar. I can stir it up myself. And then you show Ben like, and right beneath the screen, you can see him stirring and stirring. And he says, well, the arson is like this. He says, wait a minute, I got it. And he raises the cup to his eye, his mouth, and the spoon goes in his eye.
Oh.
And it's, oh, and then it cuts away at like, you know, and like, oh, no. And then someone leans in and says, Ben, would you like coffee? No!
That is more Police Squad.
That is, yeah, I didn't mean for it to go quite there. But I do, and it's funny, yeah, I realized why, I'm looking at the title of the episode, and I said, why did I bring up the Firefly? I know I mentioned the Firebug. Did I say the Firefly? I was arguing with myself earlier if I wanted. The Firefly? The villain?
The Firebug Batman villain is what you said.
Okay, because about 5 minutes before I made this call, I was actually looking in my old, one of my favorite comics, Who's Who, from the mid-80s, and I was looking up Firefly and Firebug are on the same page. And Firebug starts fires, but there is a Batman villain from the 50s called the Firefly. And I looked up his modus operandi. He was like a special effects lighting guy who used lighting and such to commit crimes. So he had nothing to do with that. But it was called The Hornet and the Firefly. And the moment I came up, I thought, wait a minute, that's a Batman villain. not the same guy, unfortunately.
No.
But, so let's see. I think I just have a couple more things. Oh, I love when Mike has brought Ben to the meeting. The commissioner said no. Britt is talking with Miss Case, and then all of a sudden, I forget if there's a knock at the door, and they, you know, say for Mike to come in or whatever it is, but Britt says something like, oh, here's Sir Lancelot. Come on in, Mike, which is a great moment.
Yeah, because he knocks on the window.
Yes, yeah.
And he's like, and he tells him to come in, and he's like, yeah, here comes Sir Lancelot. I love that.
What else do you have? I think that's all I have for this one.
Well, should we talk about the ending?
Yes, let's do it.
The ending is, basically what happens is that Kato and Green Hornet comes in, and they're trying to stop Ben. Ben sees them and throws firebombs. First Mike gets away.
Yeah.
Because he uncuffs him, I think. And so they're brawling when Green Hornet comes in, but Ben knocks out Mike, and then he throws his fire smoke bomb water balloon things at them and starts a fire, and he throws one over by Mike and starts a fire. Well, then Green Hornet fights with him, and or is it Kato? No, I can't remember.
It was Kato, isn't it? Because I remember boxes falling and Kato leaping back at one point.
Yeah, And but basically what happens is that he doesn't have the helmet to the fire suit, but he, or the hot suit, but he gets knocked into the fire and they leave him to roast.
Yeah. It's there. I mean, I guess, oh gosh, I really feel like we should have begun to tally how many people they seem to kill or accidentally kill, from those guys they roast in that armored truck to, what is it, Sunny Boy or whatever, Honey Boy or whatever his name
Honey
is.
Honey Boy, they blow up.
They blow up Honey Rocket. Boy. Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, they leave him there. And it's, yeah, and it's like, and yeah, and so it goes to the final scene. And it's like they're trying to sort of play up that Mike's kind of a hero, but Mike doesn't want it because Mike's motto is, you can kill me all you want, but I'm Mike. So it doesn't really matter. Right. You know, you're still if you're my friend, you're my friend.
Yeah, and that was a really kind of emotional moment because he's like, we downplay this story? And they're like, yes. Yeah, but you're the hero. And he's like, no, he deserves better. And Casey's like, he tried to kill you.
Yes.
He's like, yeah, but he didn't.
Yeah, there you go. and the episode ends, and what are the last two words of the episode?
Poor Mike.
They must have known. That must have been something where they were like in the writer's room and like above the, well, they didn't have writer's rooms in the 60s, but they must have had like a bulletin board, and whoever it was who was in charge of the stories just had like a post-it or an index card at the top that said Poor Mike above the top. So work that in. I guess we'll do. Do you have anything else on this one?
Yes, I have one big thing, did you recognize who Ben Wade was?
The whole time I sat there looking at him, thinking I recognized him, but then the eye patch kept distracting me, and I thought he was like he played Long John Silver in something. So who was he?
Ben Wade was played by Gerald S. O'Loughlin, who played Captain E.G. Boyd on Automan.
Whoa!
Yes.
Stay tuned, folks. Stay tuned to this podcast.
And he was also in, of course, because I have to work in my Hawaii Five-O episode, Hawaii Five-O references. He played Swanson in two episodes of Hawaii Five-O. One was called The Box, and the other one was called 6 Kilos. But the Box episode is known. I wrote about it on my blog. You can read all about it because Gavin McLeod in it as Big Chicken. And I did a character study on Big Chicken, and it's a very kind of disturbing episode because it takes place in a prison shower, and the prison shower is basically a broken pipe that trickles water. I don't even understand it.
Wow.
So yes, Hawaii
5-0 is far more interesting than I ever gave it credit for. I guess the thing, folks, with the best shows are always far more interesting than we probably ever give them credit for. So the more you talk about Hawaii Five-O, and the more I wait for your Book'em Dano cast, I'm very excited about it, and I'll gladly be a guest on it.
I look forward to having you on, Dan, as soon as I get this together.
It's going to be fantastic. I'm interested to see what format you're going to do, because me, I'd start from the beginning, but I don't know if that works for Hawaii Five-O. I don't know.
Yeah, it could. It's just that it's 12 seasons, so you're going to have to.
Multiple episodes
just to get through it, because it's quite extensive.
Yeah, of course this is a show where we're spending like a half an hour every 2 weeks talking about one episode of Green Hornet from 1966. So I don't know, maybe. And I was gonna say we spent in the past we spent an hour talking about Manimals, and Amanda and I spent at least 45 minutes talking about every episode of Joni Loves Chachi. So I think Hawaii Five-0 probably deserves it, if any show does.
Yeah, there's a lot there. There's a lot there.
Do you have anything else before we go on to just final thoughts and wrap up?
No, I don't have anything else. Okay. I just really like this episode. Poor Mike.
Okay. Yeah, I almost, it's every once in a while with episodes like this, is like the first time I watched it, I was like, all right, I liked it. The second time I got to the end, and I was taking notes, and I thought, why didn't I like this as much the first time? And that was the only reason I could think of. I could be wrong. Sometimes it takes multiple viewings to get it completely right. But yeah, that's Hornet and the Firefly. And Kristen, where can we, what up? Where can we find you online?
You can find me at my blog, kikiwritesabout.com.
Yay!
It's got links to all my published work, links to my Patreon. You can buy me a coffee. It's got all my Rerun Junkie posts. I have been writing about Hawaii Five-O lately, so...
You have. She has. It's been great.
Yeah. And if you need my random thoughts in real time, you can follow me on Twitter at Kiki Writes.
Nice. And you had a new book out, or a novella. I purchased it. I haven't read it yet.
Oh, thank you for buying it. It's a novella, novelette called Come to the Rocks. Someone called it adorable and... Or was it cute and vengeful? And that is me, and that is that story. It's a wonderful little story.
True.
It's got a mermaid. It's got a stalker. It's beautiful. It really is.
Wonderful. I can't wait to read it. So that was a Hornet the Firefly, everybody. And I guess I'll just end with two of my favorite words relating to Green Hornet. Poor Mike. Poor Mike.
Bourbon Street Beat.
Bourbon Street Beat.
Starring Richard Long.
In New Orleans.
Andrew Duggan.
This is the blues.
With Arlene Howell and Van Williams. Produced by Warner Brothers.
All right, today we are talking episode 4 of Bourbon Street Beat, October 26, 1959, Woman in the River, directed by Mr. Leslie H. Martinson, written by Luther Davis. Now, I'm going to try to keep the plot synopsis on this one a little bit calmer than on the last one so we can get right to Mitchell and myself chatting. But it begins with a young man named Tony going to a very sort of hyperactive and, oh my God, young man going to the police station and saying his girlfriend, his gal, Elise Brown, has gone missing. The cops basically tell him to hit the skids. And so Tony goes to visit the folks at the agency. And they're talking with Rex, they're talking with Cal, and we learn, well, first off, yeah, Elise has gone missing. Elise is, she works for a construction agency, what is it, like L.E. Duffy Construction Company, who are known for building roads deep in the bayou, like swamp country, big time. And she works for at Mr. Duffy. She also participates in a theater group. Tony says, yeah, she just vanished a little while ago, and she doesn't have any of her stuff, and she's just gone, and please find her. Comes out after a little chat that Lisa and Tony are actually married, but they haven't told anyone. So the guys begin their investigation, and they go to visit Ally Duffy. Like I said, deep in swampland, where things are a little weird down there, and... We'll go into how they're a little bit weird, and then they go to the theater company, where you learn that Elise presents herself as a very nice gal, but she may be a bit sort of willing to do whatever she needs to do to get what she wants kind of thing. And they go to her apartment, and she has a big blow-up like photo of herself with like things like, I forget what the labels are, we talk about them, but like things point like to her hips and saying like, slimmer hips, you know, bigger hair, you know, stuff like that. She's very, intent upon improving herself any way she can. Then they end up going to visit Tony's parents, and it turns out Tony's very wealthy, but they keep him in line. And they knew of Elise, and they didn't know about the marriage. And the dad seems very much like, she's not really our kind of people. But the mom is very much like, oh, I really like Elise. And they begin to investigate more and more. And somewhere within there, as a big storm is approaching. I forget if it's almost like hurricane level sort of storm is approaching. As Rex and Cal are sort of sneaking to Ally Duffy's place to check some stuff, they run into two old swamp rats. Well, two swamp guys who are there who may or may not have something to do with what happened to Elise. And with this storm coming, she might be in great danger. And I don't just mean that metaphorically, I mean physically also. Physically and metaphorically, Elise is going to be in great danger. So let us hop right to the chat. I'm going to play you a blast, and then we'll get started. Here you go.
Bourbon Street Beat.
What do Laura Petrie, Mr. Drysdale, and Uncle Jesse all have in common? Mitchell?
This sounds like an answer to Karnak the Magnificent.
Yes, I'll open that envelope.
They are all in The Woman in the River.
Oh, it's awesome! I think you guys are gonna like this episode. I'm here with the great Mitchell Hadley. How are you, Mitchell?
I am doing just well. How are you?
I'm doing great. I want to dive right into this one. No pun intended. I forgot what I was saying. Mitchell, give me your broad overview on it, then I'll give you mine, and we'll dive into some specifics. Go.
Well, this is a pure mystery right here. You come up at the very beginning. They've got a client. The client hires them to find a missing person who may or may not be missing, who may or may not be dead. You've got secrets that the client has. You have a family who may not necessarily be interested in having the missing woman found. You have all the elements of a good mystery. Then you find out that the missing woman is Mary Tyler Moore. What else could
Holy
you ask?
Mackerel.
They walk into this room and there's this giant poster and wow. And for three quarters of the episode, that's all you see of her.
Yes. I really like this episode. I thought it was really good. A really good one.
Yes. I did too.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Did you have more? I didn't want to.
No, not at this point. I think we can dive in more.
I think this is like you said. There's something about it. It starts off with sort of an overwrought guy who's missing. My gal's gone missing. But then as it goes along, it gets kind of dark and a little strange and. Everyone in the main cast gets to join in, which is wonderful, and just things get weirder and weirder, unlike, say, the Morning Cloak, where they arrive at the Gothic Mansion, and then the thunder and lightning starts, but then it all stops when they return, and then they come back. This one starts off sort of calm, and then, like, the second half is rainfall and flooding and just craziness, and just, like, and it kind of builds to a really nice, well, I didn't see the end coming, and there's just a moment in it where it's like, whoa, and unlike the last two episodes where I had some problems with some of the structure, this one I think I was pretty happy throughout with it. I can't think of any moment where I was like, and I could tell that because the previous two episodes I have gaps in my notes, which is when I'm unable to fully pay attention, I stop taking notes.
Mm-hmm.
This one I have full notes throughout. Now, not that we're going to go on for 2 hours, but just suffice to say, full notes means I think it was a very good time.
Yes, I think it was the characters were well drawn. You get the sense that when the young man comes to Rex and Cal for help, and what is he's a distant relative of there of Rex, isn't he?
Does he say it to Cal? I think it's like, I'm a distant nephew or something, yeah, like that, or a cousin or something, and Cal says, I don't have any family or something like that, yeah. Or something, yeah.
But because he isn't sure who Rex is, and he walks in and sees Cal there, and he assumes that must be Rex.
Yes.
But once they get that all straightened out, just the way that they take him into the family.
Yeah.
And he says something about whether or not he can pay the fee. Cal makes some comment about, we don't worry about that when it's in the family.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Then they have him sit down and sample some of Rex's cooking, which is again a big part of this episode.
Yes. Yeah.
And they convince him that with what we're going to be doing, you need to keep up your strength and sit down and join us for lunch.
Yeah, and it's crayfish bisque with just the right amount of time. I mean, I feel like it may have been like, and I don't mean to sound horribly sexist or something, but like maybe there was like a magazine that was coming out at the time that would go to housewives, pardon me, everyone, and it would have like a Bourbon Street Beat recipe in it. Like, if you watch this week, ladies, you can make some crayfish bisque or something like that. Hey, I do it. So, but
if they had done that, maybe they would have made it to a second season.
Yeah, oh, that would have been great. That would have been great. But I mean, they've done the bisque, and they did some sort of bouillabaisse or something in the previous episode. He did the mint juleps in the episode before, so he's making. And I think at the end of the episode, when all is said and done, they're discussing jambalaya.
Mm-hmm.
So they were.
That's a nice.
Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, and there is that great moment where is it Tony Picard is the guy's name, and he just said, "Well, do you have a picture of her or whatever?" Yeah, here she is, or I forget when they first see a picture of her.
When they walk into her apartment, and she's got that like life size poster. Yeah. Where she's written notes about how to keep herself in shape and where to concentrate. Mm-hmm. And you're right. And it's one of those OMG moments for us because we know who she is.
Yeah, it's like, holy crap, are you for real? And then I kept thinking, and I guess this might be a bit of a spoiler, folks, but we kind of mentioned it earlier. She does appear in the episode. It isn't like we only see her picture the whole time. She is actually in the episode. In what capacity? We'll try not to say.
It could be flashbacks.
Yes, it could be flashbacks. Yes,
you just
exactly.
have to watch and find out. But for a while there, I thought this was going to be kind of the equivalent of the role she played in Richard Diamond. When it was legs. I thought this was going to be the flip side of the coin. You would see her, but you'd never hear her.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's actually what I thought too. I was sitting there going, "What was that show? Oh, she was in Richard Diamond." Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So they see this poster, and I'm just waiting for one of them to take Tony to one side and say, "Son, don't you think that might be just a little too much woman for you?"
Tony does have a bit of a, "She's my gal, man. Come on. She's my gal. She's the most beautiful gal around." And then you see her and you're like, "Whoa, hey, you you don't get a lot of protein, a lot of nourishment, Tony, because I think you got to see Dick Van Dyke could fall all over the place. Can you do stuff like that? Because that's what's going to be required. Or you got to be Ed Asner." So
yes, yes.
Tony, you are neither of those. I don't care if your dad is Mr. Drysdale without his hairpiece.
Yeah, you know that. It took me a little while to recognize him, to place him there. But oh yeah, that's Mr. Drysdale. And then Tony's mother is Jeanette Nolan.
Yes. Yeah. There's so many. Yeah, so many great actors. And then
Pyle is in it.
Denver Pyle shows up, and you're like, what?
Halfway through.
Yes.
Halfway through, you introduce Denver Pyle.
Yeah, and he plays this great. He's a swamp rat. He and his friend are two swamp rats who we won't say exactly what they get up to, but it's not nice.
No, it's no good.
And he's got this kind of vague thing where he's like, they're questioning about something, and I don't remember the names of things. Well, what did you guys do after this thing? Oh, the other guy took me and he got me some of those Frankfurter things. And he keeps referring like, and it's just these weird, wonderful moments. And it's there's a bit where like he's in a prison cell with this guy, and it's thunder and lightning and pouring rain, and he's like holding on to the metal bars of the cell. And I kept expecting like it to get struck by lightning, and you're gonna see like Denver Pyle light up. It doesn't happen. Spoiler: that does not happen.
But then Cal winds up sharing the cell undercover.
Yes,
and he catches on that Denver Pyle has this fixation on the levees breaking, and part of it getting flooded, which obviously he knows the architecture of New Orleans better than the Army Corps of Engineers did a few years ago.
Yeah.
But Cal finds out that's his weak spot, and he just keeps hammering on, oh, yeah, this road's already flooded out and all this kind of, you know, and this whole area is flooded, and he just really presses the button.
Yeah, yeah, I was very surprised. They show some stock footage of flooding, but then they actually have
stock footage on here too, you know, or file footage. Yeah.
Yeah, and but then when they actually get to this place they're going to that's flooded, it's actually sort of convincingly. I don't know if it was like a little pond somewhere on the Warner Brothers studio that they put like a shack in or something. But it looks, I was convinced by it
Yes.
when they actually cut to the space where this little shack is. For a split second, I thought it was a stock footage thing because the water was still flowing, but it wasn't. It was the actual thing. So no, that's well done. Well done, you
Good.
guys.
Again, the atmosphere that generated was terrific. It was it managed to be claustrophobic and just all this water, this grime, and it was very oppressive.
Well, yeah, constantly bring up water moccasins and did they say it was Gator Country or they didn't say it was Shark Country. It was a Gator Country. Okay.
And isn't there a scene earlier too when he is trying to find out some things about Mary Tyler Moore and his car gets stuck?
Oh yeah, Rex gets his car stuck at Al E. Duffy's construction company.
Yes, and he's gonna take his shoes off to push his car out, and the one guy says, "You might not want to do that with the water moccasins."
Yeah, you step in there, you'll never come out.
And again, you're thinking that he's weighing the possibility of getting bitten by a water moccasin versus ruining
Ruining those shoes.
probably a new pair of shoes,
Yes.
probably.
Yeah. Let's see. It was so weird because just a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I watched a Battle of the Network Stars with Dan Haggerty as a captain on it. And so about a week ago, I started watching, well, I've only done the first couple, Life and Times of Grizzly Adams, with Denver
Yes.
Pyle on it. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's so great to see him without a beard and everything. He's clean shaven, and he looks, when he has the beard and everything, he has sort of the Uncle Jesse kind of wise older gentleman without the beard and stuff. He's one step away from being, who's that one guy with the wonky eye? I've suddenly forgotten his name.
Oh, Marty
What's
Feld.
no he's the I'm gonna remember his name in a moment. He shows up in a lot of stuff. And oh crap, why am I forgetting his name? I'll get his name in a moment. But he reminded me sort of a variation of that guy. He's a big guy. Ah crap, I'll remember it later, folks. I'm sorry, that just came to me right now. But so what else do we have? Yeah, I like there's a moment when we see Cal and Melody have gone to see a movie. And it's great because Cal is talking about how sad the movie. It sounds like a Lassie Come Home or something like
Yes,
that.
yes.
And Cal's talking about how sad it was, and the Baron and the band start playing something really sad. And then as they're playing, the Baron says like, "Well, how was the ending?" And Melody says, "It was happy. One, two, three, commit your troubles. Come on, get happy." And I'm like, "That's good band, is what
It
that is."
reminded me of a scene from Hogan's Heroes. Now, going off on another tangent here, but Hogan was giving the sob story to Schultz about why Schultz should overlook something, and he's talking about how he's but the oldest of seven children, and he was only five at the time, and he had to go to work, and he had three jobs to support the family, and because they didn't have any money, and then little Willie has to have this life-saving operation, and Schultz says, "Oh, I can't turn you in, Colonel Hogan," and so he goes to leave, and he's, "Oh, by the way, did you get the did little Willie have the operation?" And Hogan says, "Yes. Where did you get the money for the operation?" He says, "Yes, we took it out of the bank." And it's kind of that same thing where they reveal the sad story but a happy ending.
I did figure out who the wonky-eyed guy I was thinking of. Jack Elam.
Oh, yes.
So Denver Pyle without a beard has a non-wonky-eye Jack Elam feel to him.
That's a very good comparison.
They would have been great together. Well, they were probably, they must have been in something
I
together,
would
I would
have to
think.
think that they were. I would be shocked if they weren't.
Let's see, what else is there? Oh, this is great because the episode begins. Finally, Kenny gets something to do. in this episode. He gets to do some investigation with Melody, and he and Melody get to do a sort of It Happened One Night kind of scene where they go out in the rain and they get soaked, and then they wind up in Allie Duffy's, like, somewhere in Allie Duffy's construction site looking for stuff, and they're both sort of, you know, as stripped down as one can be on 1959 television with the blanket hanging up in between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a nice touch there.
That was a really sweet scene because they're comparing this information they're finding, and you could see, like, Van Williams getting peaky looking over the sheet. Melody Lee's like, And I didn't quite realize that they were a couple until
I had more or less assumed that this was wishful thinking on his part.
Yes.
But then at the end of the episode, they did that awful soul-to-soul.
I'm not sure about that soul-to-soul thing. You know,
no. I don't think we should even describe that to the listeners. We don't want to turn them off from the series.
Yeah. How about this, folks? If it happens four times, the fourth time we will tell you what it is. We'll do
agreed.
That.
Yes.
So because it might not happen. But they, yeah, apparently they're a couple, and it actually, the episode begins with Kenny taking pictures of Melody Lee, and when they're sort of finishing up, he says something like, "How about some cheesecake?" You know, and something like, "How about, like," I don't think he quite says this, but "How about some leg action?"
Yes.
And leg action in 1959 means you can almost see her knees. Which is woo!
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. In about 10 years from now, you are all going to be very surprised at what you can see when it comes to leg action.
But you still can't see Jeannie's belly button.
No, you cannot. You cannot. Let's see. What else? You know, can I... One point that I found interesting about it is that when the episode begins, Mary Tyler Moore's character... Elise, I think, is her.
Elise.
And she's presented as they call her the self-improvement kid, and she does this job at this construction site, and she's part of this theater company, all this stuff. But as the episode goes along, it sounds like she's, I don't want to say shady, but they say something like she one of her, like, theater partner says something like, she won't take it unless it'll fit in her wallet.
Yes.
And so as it goes along, she sounds like she's doing, in order to get jobs, in order to sort of get this, it sounds like she's doing shadier and shadier things. But at the end of the episode, I'm trying not to spoil it, but
it's Mary Tyler Moore.
Yeah, at the end of the episode, that isn't dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that's something that should have been dealt with, or does it not matter at the end of the episode anymore?
Well, that's interesting, because there is, as you said, there's this moment when you start to wonder, just what was she playing the kid? Was she involved in something else or with someone else? Is she at the heart of this plot?
That's what it feels like at certain moments. It feels like she's doing something with Al E. Duffy. And I don't know why I don't just call him Al or Mr. Duffy, but I like saying the whole name.
Al
E. Duffy Construct. You feel like maybe she's doing something with him that's shady. She might be or she might not be, but it's just weird because when it ends in such a way that none of that is addressed.
Yes.
And you wonder if, like I said, you wonder if one, it should be at that point, after what we all go through in the episode, or two, if maybe it was meant to be, it was meant to be addressed and maybe got cut out or something.
Well, you remember there's in the scene where they're talking with the theater troupe, and by the way, how would you like to have season tickets to there?
I'd rather spend the day with beatniks.
Yes,
I really would.
Yes, this was, trust us, folks, this was not the kind of theater you want to go see.
No.
But you'll remember they're questioning on the members of the troupe, and they seem to have very divided opinions as to what kind of a person she was. There was somebody else in there who liked her, and she had that some line like, she invented driven snow.
Yes.
You know, she's not only is she as pure as the driven snow, she invented it.
Yeah.
So it could be that there is some, forgive me if this sounds sexist, but there could be some female jealousy at work.
Because they do mention there's the one woman who really doesn't like her, who says, I went for the same job that she did at Allie Duffy's Construction with Allie Duffy, the guy who runs the construction company. And she said, I type more than she does. We went to the same secretarial school. I type more than she does and a few other things. But she went to meet with him on a Saturday, and on a Monday she had the job. And I can guess what that means.
Yeah, draw your own.
And poor Anthony, you know, or Tony, he's just like, I think he is just gonna get laid waste by the self-improvement kid. I think she's gonna leave him in the dust and end up marrying Dick Van Dyke.
Yes, that's the only way it can happen.
There's a lot of stuff in this episode with when Melody is getting in Kenny's car and it looks like it's going to rain, and she says, put the top up because it looks like it's going to rain pitchforks and tadpoles. I don't know what that means. I don't fully understand all my colloquial New Orleans at this moment. We're still learning, folks.
But you know, that's like kind of what I was saying earlier about it looks like what you think New Orleans ought to look like. This sounds like what it ought to sound like too.
And this is great because they mention that these guys are they call them swamp rats, right? Gator Joe and someone else. We don't really see much swamp. We see flooded areas. But I mean, I got to tell you, I don't know if this is too close to quicksand, but if you can throw on a few episodes ago, I had a short list of things that you put in something, and I'll watch it. Swamps are another. You put a swamp in something, I'm in.
Swamps are good, especially if you can see a little trail as through the waters, if there was something big and nasty coming at you.
Oh, I love a good shot of a swamp where you like you get the tree stumps and like things like sticking out of the water.
And you know what else goes well with swamps? Leeches.
Oh yes.
Yes.
Yeah, you know what? I would say 90% of the time you put a leech in a film, I'm there. You put a giant leech in a film, I'm there twice.
Yes, that's just a given. I'll give it one star just for the leeches.
Exactly. You have leeches in a swamp with quicksand, and someone escapes in a hot air balloon.
While somebody is shooting at them.
I'm in. all right, so let's see. What else do you have for this one? I think I'm getting near the end of my notes here.
I was amused by the title, Woman in the River, because I thought, well, that's the difference between movies and television, because in the movies you have Lady in the Lake, but in on TV you can only have Woman in the River. I mean, smaller budget, you know. We don't have the budget for a lake. It's only a river, so.
There is that moment in there where the Tony's mom goes to the morgue because they found a woman in the river. And it's another gal who died in the river. And it's interesting because there are all these moments like you think, oh my gosh, it's going to be her. And what are we? But it's not her. It's someone else completely. And this was sort of a side trip. And there are a lot of nice little moments and side bits and bobs that kind of keep you from you don't expect Denver Pyle to show up like two-thirds of the way into it and be so strange, and you don't expect Cal to get shot.
Right.
I didn't expect that.
And the episode is just unpredictable enough in that way that when they go to the morgue, you really expect that might be her.
Yeah. I did.
That would not have surprised me in the least if it had turned out that was her and that she was dead, and that the whole second half of the show is going in a different direction.
I was very impressed by this episode. I thought if this is what the show is going to be, I'm in. And there's also just the fact that everyone got, like, in the end, sort of everyone's there. And, you know, it's I like seeing everyone. I mean, one of my favorite shows the past year or two that I've been watching is The Virginian.
Ah, yes.
Possibly my favorite possibly my favorite, because I love Maverick, possibly my favorite sort of serious adult Western, sort of. But there are a lot of episodes in that, because it was a 90-minute Western, where they separate everybody. And I don't mind that they do that. I think they generally handle it well. But the episodes when everyone's assembled and you get Trampas and the judge and the Virginian and Steve when Steve's there, you know, when you get everyone assembled, yeah, they're really lovely moments.
We were over at a friend's house a few weeks ago, and there wasn't anything special on TV at the time. And we were surfing around and hit on the Virginian, and she had not seen it before, and every 15 minutes or so, when another character comes on the screen, she said, "Is that the Virginian? No, that's not him. That's Trampas and everything." She is perhaps the only person who's ever seen two episodes of the Virginian, neither of which have the Virginian in them.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, end of the second episode, we've spent close to 3 hours on these two episodes, and we had to tell her he wasn't in that one either. Yeah. You have not seen the Virginian. And she said, "But the name of the show is the Virginian, right?" And I said, "Yep, yes, that's right."
Yeah.
And he isn't in it. No, not in these.
I really love the show, but there are. Luckily, I love the Virginian. I love James Drury, and I love I can watch Doug McClure in anything. So.
And B.J. Cobb has a real gravitas to that, a dignity to that role too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We'll wrap up the episode. The Virginian. Maybe I'll do a Virginian podcast one day. We'll go through once I have to do my Rockin' All Week with You Happy Days podcast. I am determined to do that. Two episodes at a time. Amanda will join me for the post-Richie seasons. But I have to find... I'm still struggling to find someone who will join me for the bulk of the Richie season. I could do it myself. But Woman in the River. Anything else, Mitch?
No, I would say that this is the strongest episode to date, discounting the first one, which was really just a setup. This was, I thought, a good overall episode in every way.
Yeah, I agree. That was Woman in the River. And Mitchell, online, I'm trying to find you, but I can't. I'm looking in the wrong spot. Where am I?
Well, I don't know where you are, but where you ought to be is...
It hurts.
Yeah. unless I've become a victim of the new internet rules, it should be able to find me at itsabouttv.com.
All right. Thank you once again, Mitchell. Until next time, here's a little blast.
Bourbon Street Freaks.
This model train enthusiast just highballed his last fleet. Who killed him? Was it his wife?
That means the killer had to know how the system worked.
The trusted employee.
Emily, he's dead. Why go into all that?
His domineering wife.
Lamont had become senile. We all knew that.
The ambitious tycoon.
Inspector, I believe you are calling me a liar.
The playboy brother-in-law.
Wait a minute. I didn't even know about that door.
Or was it someone else? Match wits with Ellery Queen and see if you can guess who done it.
Episode 14 of Ellery Queen Mysteries, The Adventure of the Eccentric Engineer. Original air date, January 18th, 1976. Directed by Peter H. Hunt, written by David P. Lewis and Booker Bradshaw. There is an inventor who has quit his job and is devoting all of his time to hanging out in a guest house outside of his mansion playing with toy trains. His wife thinks he's nuts. a coworker who lives nearby, and the coworker's wife, or ex-coworker, I should say, both think he's nuts. And one night when they go out to the theater, the inventor is killed. Oh boy. And Ellery and Inspector Queen and Sergeant Veeley and a new lady friend for Ellery, who we will hear about soon, oh, we'll talk about soon, all begin to investigate what's going on. They check out his trains, they talk to his wife, they talk to his brother-in-law, they talk to the neighbors there, they talk to people he worked with, just trying to find out, was he as nutty as everyone says he was? The answer seems to be, maybe not, but we'll discuss that. Let's go to the living room. Bump, bump. Hey, bump, everyone.
Bump. Van Dyke.
Van Patten.
Van Patten.
that might be a little hint as to someone who is in this episode. We're not going to give it away completely.
Even if we did just pretty much give it away completely.
We kind of just gave it away completely, but that's all right. There's magic.
Dick Joyce or Tim?
There's magic in the early morning we found,
mm-hmm.
If I can just say that. When the sunrise smiles on everything around. Isn't that lovely?
That is beautiful.
Who
wrote that? Whitman?
It was Whitman, yeah. Joyce DeWitt.
DeWittman.
DeWittman. Joyce mm-hmm. DeWittman. Hey, everyone. It's me, Dan. You just heard me talking about The Adventure of the Eccentric Engineer, and I'm here with my sweet wife, Madeline.
This guy in the talking.
Oh, my gosh. The McManning it. McMayonnaise. That's good. So, yeah, this episode is about a famous inventor named Ed McMahon. Okay. No, he's...
Yeah.
What is his name?
You know, Lamont.
Lamont.
Which I thought, when did people stop naming their kids Lamont?
Yeah, that's too bad.
Isn't that the name of the guy on Sanford and Son? Wasn't that his son's
yeah,
name?
Yeah, Lamont, your big Lamont. Dummy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Lamont yeah. Lamont Cranston was the shadow.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And this has a moment, we're hopping around here, but it has a moment where Ellery... We're going to meet... This is another one of those episodes with one of Ellery's lady friends in it. Although she doesn't start off as his lady friend, but she becomes his lady friend. Oh, in fact, let's play... I'm going to play you this clip where he meets Miss Farnsworth.
I've always felt that the essence of the creative mind is due to its ability to function independently of the environment, which, of course, explains such phenomena as Gauguin and Chekhov and even the Brontes. Oh, that is Charlotte and Emily, not Anne. Who is a minor talent, don't you agree? Mr. Queen?
Huh?
Anne Bronte?
Well, I don't know, Miss Farnsley.
Worth.
Miss Worth.
Farnsworth.
Miss Farnsworth. What paper did you say you wrote for?
Oh, I'm doing a paper on you at my American Lit class at Hunter College.
Oh, well, that's very flattering.
No, it's not. Mr. Queen, I have been dreadful. I've lied to you, and I feel that... If our relationship is to have any meaning, it should be based on truth, don't you agree?
Well, actually, I hadn't given our relationship much thought.
The fact is I'm writing a book and I desperately need your help. I'm only up to page 35.
Oh, you want me to help you write a mystery story?
Oh, no, a love story.
Well, I don't write, Would you excuse me?
Certainly.
Thank you.
She's nice. I forget the actress's name.
Anne Rankin.
Yes.
Who is a... beautiful dancer. She did a lot of Bob Fosse stuff. And
oh, okay, yeah.
So, theater actress.
She's great in this. They do the thing where, and this may be hopping ahead, and I consider it spoilers to spoil the mystery. I don't consider it spoilers to spoil what Ellery gets up to, if you know what I mean. Outside of the mystery. But she starts off very much like she's got her hair pulled back and she's got the glasses on.
Well, that can only go one place.
There may be a moment later on where she lets the hair down and does up her nails in a bright red and wears a very shiny, fun dress.
She does.
And suddenly Ellery and even Mr. Queen, like, it's a moment where she steps forward. I don't know if it's spoiling to tell why she suddenly goes from being frumpy to in the dress.
She's helping him.
She's helping him with something, yeah.
She's helping Ellery work on the solving of the mystery.
Yes.
And they solve the mystery of her hot, hot body.
How hot is she?
And all of a sudden, yeah. It's like, oh, glasses and a ponytail.
Oh,
and they're gone. It's like such a lack of imagination to not realize.
Yeah.
She was a beautiful woman under that all the time.
And so sort of Ellery standing up and his jaw drops and Inspector Queen kind of comes out from behind him. Revealing how tiny he is compared to Ellery. It's good fun. So
Ed McMahon, Lamont,
yes.
Franklin, a little trivia. My dad went to college with Ed McMahon.
Really? What college was that?
Catholic University. Oh, wow. On the GI Bill. So I think they were in the same, somewhere in the back room. It's my dad's yearbook with Ed McMahon in it.
What?
I know.
That's fantastic. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow,
I'm
sure, so
I've
yeah.
I've told you that before.
Everyone, if you're listening right now, you are so close degrees wise to Ed McMahon.
So close.
That's
just
astounding.
A couple degrees
yeah.
of separation.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I never met the man. My father possibly never did either, but they did go to the same college.
Yeah. Yeah, and Ed gets killed by someone. He's got
Jerks.
This great train layout, this great train set.
Yes, it's so elaborate.
Yeah, and it's and they think his family and his neighbors, this couple who live like three blocks away, one of who he works with, think that he's gone nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Although his wife's brother, Doug, doesn't think he's gone nuts. He thinks it's an act. He
thinks it's an act.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Ed McMahon's back there writing, you know, little code for his railroad, and mm-hmm. he even wears the engineer hat.
Yes, he's dressed up like the engineer and everything, mm-hmm. and his workshop is set aside from the main house, but and it's so awesome. He's got, like, just, there's a tunnel, I guess, that goes underground, mm-hmm. and when people want to contact him, I guess they can either come to the work the place with a pass.
You would love that.
Oh my gosh, wouldn't
that
be great?
If you had your own little.
Oh, they had a little train room, and I just sit and play with my trains, and everyone would think that Budnick, he's gone around the bend,
mm-hmm.
and you'd put your hair up real big and put a flower in it and talk about how you were going to have to take care of me when I finally go cuckoo.
Mm-hmm.
And then your brother, who's about 30 years younger than you are,
it's strange. Yeah, that is strange.
He's
young. And he also reminded me of Rick Moranis. Moranis. I can never say his name right. You say it.
Rick Moranis.
Moranis.
Yeah, and
He looked like him in a brown wig.
Yes, yeah, he mm-hmm. looked like sort of one of a mix of several SCTV characters.
Yeah.
Turning Japanese.
I really think so. Jerry Todd here with Ikigaki.
And even a little bit from a distance of that one guy, Her Guy Friday, you remember that one?
Oh, yes. I love that. I said, listen, sister.
But there is a moment where, because Dorothy Malone plays his wife, and Dorothy Malone, I don't know, she's in mid-50s or so, I would say.
Sure.
And when they show her brother, I thought it was meant to be their son or something, because he looks
at
least
20 to 25
years.
Listen, maybe the father remarried.
Oh, true. Yeah.
You men can do that.
Or they were just very surprised one day. Wow, we had our last kid 25 years ago. Who knew?
He just fell out.
Who knew?
I don't like to spoil who did it, but it was Johnny Carson.
It was.
It was a surprise ending.
Oh, Johnny Carson.
I can't do it, Johnny. I could do one, and it ended abruptly and quickly. What'd you think of this episode, Daniel?
Oh, I really like it. I think it's a good one. It's got, we won't spoil the ending, but it has an ending that's kind of
Carson
related. It has an ending that's very, they do a lot of nice misdirection,
mm-hmm.
and then the ending is sort of like, I think they prepare it nicely, but they prepare it sort of, and I can't really say, but there's something happens or doesn't happen, and something.
Did you hear that, listener? Something
happens
or doesn't happen,
and then we're shown something that may or may not be a clue, and then in the end, it's like, oh, okay, these two things tie together. And it's.
I
wish we could tell you.
I'm as confused as you are, and I've seen the episode.
I wish we could tell you what's going on, folks. What did you think of it, Ben?
Well, I love their maid Bridget, the Irish maid.
Oh yes, yes.
I did love. I liked his relationship with the budding author there.
Yes. Yeah, they would you mind if I just played real
would
quick?
You?
This is the second time they meet up, because Ellery, well, he doesn't really say he'll meet
She's
with her
persistent.
The next morning. She's persistent, says, I'll see you, I'll be here at 9, and Ellery rushes out.
He blows her off, let's
and,
be honest.
But then
the
when they're in the police station, she shows up and here's that encounter.
Dad, I want to take another look at that workshop.
What for?
Because I think I'm right. I think Franklin was working on something important enough to have gotten him killed. Yes, I do. Come on, let's go.
Oh, Mr. Queen. I didn't think I'd find you here. You must have forgotten about our date this morning.
Good morning, Miss Farnsworth. Miss Farnsworth, this is my dad. Dad, this is Miss Farnsworth.
Charmed, young lady.
How do you do, sir? I brought my notes. I thought we could discuss them over lunch. Oh, Dutch Street, of course.
I'll warm up the car.
Well, I'll be right with you. I really am sorry.
I brought two books, John Tyler, American Patriot, and Tyler Presidency.
I'd like to help, but I don't write historical novels.
Oh, no, I told you. I'm writing a love story.
About John Tyler?
He had 12 children, you know.
No, I also told you I don't write love stories either.
You have no idea how difficult it is to get somebody to help you. Why, John O'Hara, he never even returned my phone calls. And Ernest Hemingway? Well, I don't even want to repeat what he said.
We are still working on this case.
Oh. Oh, I see. Well, I guess you can't be bothered with somebody who's just a nobody.
No, it's not that. I'd like to help.
You would?
But I have to help my father.
Oh, I understand. I'll meet you at your house later, and don't worry about me. I'll wait as long as I have to. Oh, gee, Mr. Queen. You're an okay Joe.
They're fun.
Ernest Hemingway.
Ernest.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, babe. Then what else?
Dick Van Dyke. Why do I keep calling him Dick Van Dyke?
I don't know.
Dick Van Patten. We were thinking that he was singing the theme to Eight Is Enough while he was running away.
That's right. That's why I was saying I had the lyric. Because there's a scene where, and I guess this is as close as a spoiler as we'll get. But one of the things is there's only one door into his workshop and one door out, and all the windows are covered. There's a secret door. Actually, it's said in the opening.
He spends his days like a bride in a shiny new dime.
Yeah,
it's just... Play the home movie with him in the window sill tonight. Hey, it is not to be lost with love.
It's magic in the early morning. We found da-da-da-da-da. It is enough for love. And then Vili tackles him. Oh, no, he falls down. It is enough for love. Wow.
That's what I listen to on my iPod when I go to the gym.
It is enough
just
for love.
Just say it is enough on a loop. I can't run away from it.
I love that concept that he's just running to it. And there's something interesting,
played
too.
Homemade wishes. He's very recalcitrant. I think Rich coached him on his audition.
Yeah. Here, listen to this. This is them. They're sitting at a park bench, and Inspector Queen and Ellery are trying to get some info out of him.
Billy, please tell them. What were you doing in the workshop?
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Save your breath, sis. He is not going to say anything.
Billy worked for Lamont for years as a design engineer. When Lamont began to lose his grip a few months ago, he fired Billy.
That true, Mr. Gator?
Look, I have nothing to say, so save your breath.
I'm sorry, Inspector. I've never seen Billy like this.
10-1, he's your killer, Inspector. Last night he murdered Lamont to steal those cards and that ledger book. When he blew it, he came back.
Why?
Why what?
Why would he want to steal these things?
Don't ask me. I never saw them before.
Mrs. Franklin?
I don't know. I just assumed he was playing with his trains.
Where were you last night, Mr. Gator, between 6:30 and 7?
There's your answer, Inspector. Come on, sis, let's go inside.
Inspector, we'll be in the kitchen if you need us.
Mr. Gator, what does all this mean, huh? These cards, the notes in this book?
I wouldn't know.
Yet he wanted them badly enough to steal. Really?
It's code, isn't it? Mr. Franklin was working on something. He was taking notes. In code, so nobody could discover what it was.
If you say so.
How'd you know where to find this stuff?
I just knew, that's all.
Were you working for Mr. Franklin? Were you trying to get this stuff so we wouldn't find it? Is that it? You know, Dad, I don't think that Mr. Franklin built that whole model layout by himself. You helped him, didn't you?
Look, I sneaked in the back way. I went straight to the desk and I jimmied open the drawer. I grabbed the cards and the book. Then I heard you coming, so I ducked out the back way while you were coming in the front way. Okay? I'm a thief, I admit it. Now if you're gonna book me, book me.
Oh, we will, Mr. Gator. Make no mistake about that. Just a question of the charges, up to and including murder.
Oh, Van Patten.
Van Patten.
Van Patten.
Just let me go.
Come on.
Just charge me or
yeah,
let me
whatever,
go.
Yeah, whatever, man. Whatever.
Whatever.
You know, whatever.
I'm not Dick Van Dyke.
And is...
Despite what that weird lady keeps saying.
What was his name in the opening credits? I don't remember.
I don't remember.
It's funny to think that, like, this is early 76, and in 2 years, Eight is Enough would start, and then Eight is Enough for, like, 3 years was a top 15 show.
Well, remember, we were all very distracted by the tall ships and the bicentennial.
Oh, that's right.
So
yeah,
maybe it just
happening.
Fell through the cracks.
Yeah, and the much-delayed Superman movie and everything. Yeah, that's right. So yeah. No Van Pattening.
Tall ships, man.
Yeah.
They were tall.
They were, yeah. Let's see. Yeah, so we get some Van Patten. We get some... Oh, and Arthur Godfrey shows up with a great hairpiece.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a fun... I think the thing I like about Arthur Godfrey in here is that in the mid-70s, well, not even in the mid-70s, but any time where you would set, if you have a show set in the late 40s when TV was just beginning and the Nielsens were starting, like, I want to say, and I'm going to say it, well, I think 48 is maybe the first year there were Nielsens, and it was Milton Berle. And then 49 or 50 was Arthur Godfrey, was number one show in America. I think it was Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts. Mm. So having him there at that time is like anyone who knew that time period would go, oh, it's Arthur Godfrey. And he's got a great hairpiece.
He does.
He does. It's really, it's lovely. It's got a lot of
heft. It's got a lot of loft.
Yes, loft. That's
loft that and heft.
That was it. Would that hairpiece have a dry or wet look?
I don't think that, no.
No? Okay.
No. The brother seemed to have a... I feel like the brother's hair was styled using a blow comb.
Oh, wow.
Do you remember those?
I vaguely remember those, yeah.
It was like a hair dryer with a comb attached.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
You just...
Yeah.
So I think that's how the brother's hair was styled.
He looks wonderful.
He lives on a boat?
He lives on a boat. And not a small boat, either. It's almost like yacht-sized boat,
yeah,
kind of.
Yeah, he lives on a boat.
And it's funny because he lives
in a suit.
He lives on a boat in a suit, and it's a really big boat. And he makes the first time they talk to him, he makes a point of saying, "Well, I got a job with a brokerage house. It's not a lot of money, but it's a good position. And I've never taken a dime from him, and yet I live on like a yacht. How did you do that?
I don't know.
How did you do?
Must have been the magic of the times.
I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe he got left it to him by the parents or something like that.
Could be. Yeah. Maybe his sister sold some of her hair.
Dorothy Malone has
a lot of hair.
Some hair in this, yeah.
Tall
hair. Very the tall hair. She was anticipating tall
and,
ships.
And Inspector Queen really doesn't like. So
yeah,
there's
the
a guy,
yeah.
The neighbor's wife, he really does not like her. He takes an immediate dislike to her. It's pretty funny. He reminds her of Ellery's Aunt Agatha, who mm-hmm. Ellery remembers as being very sweet. But oh boy, Inspector Queen does not like
does
this
not
woman.
Like her, yeah.
Which makes me wonder, Inspector Queen. Women. Mm. What are your thoughts?
What are your thoughts?
Let's talk.
Yeah.
Let's talk women.
Yeah, I wish we knew more about Ellery's mom, but we never... I from what I remember, not even in the books, we don't
I just
learn
know
much.
She must have been an Amazon.
Yeah, she must have been like, wow.
Real tall. Real
yeah,
tall.
Would have
maybe
been
she's like Big Barda.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know, I think I've said this before, yeah, that in the books, we don't... I think we find out very little about his mom.
Mm-hmm.
But... there, in one of the much later books in a book, I know I've said this, where Ellery's dad gets, I think it's the House of Brass. His dad goes on a honeymoon with his new wife. He gets married again later in the
sucks.
Books and has his own adventure in the House of Brass.
Aww.
And well, let's see, yeah.
House of Brass Blanks.
The Inspector Queen Mackers. Gets a lot of lovely moments. In this, I think
he does.
There is the moment where he sits down, Miss Farnsworth and Ellery go out for Chinese food, and he sits down. Inspector Queen sits down in the living room with the Lone Ranger on the radio and a nice cup of soup and a glass of or a bowl of soup and a glass mm-hmm. of milk and some crackers. And I was I said he put on Lone Ranger, and I was really hoping he'd put on the Green Hornet because
oh,
that would tie in
yeah.
everything so nice. But then the Lone Ranger and Green Hornet are related, so that's as close as we're going to get to something matching up like that in these well, episodes. So, which is pretty close.
Pretty close, exactly.
Yeah. Let's see what else. There's some interesting direction in this, and some interesting sort of editing and such. Like the moment where. Doug Carmichael is the suspect. We cut to a reporter on the phone, and the camera it's got a tilted kind of Batman
oh, yes.
Dutch tilt too. And it's like it's not Flanagan, unfortunately, but sending in
Lamont Franklin slain.
Yeah, Lamont Franklin slain. Doug Carmichael, brother-in-law, is suspected of, and then it fades into a radio announcer. Suspected mm-hmm. of the killing, and that's nicely done. And there's the first shot inside the big living room of the mansion of it's interesting because it starts off with on a close up of the train because the train yeah goes underground and then comes into the living room, and I was actually hoping and this is a side thing but I was hoping that there as it goes along they're sort of figuring out wait a minute maybe he wasn't as nutty as we thought and he was up to something. I was really hoping that he was trying to find a way to miniaturize everybody so he could put them all in that train and in the cars and send them through the tunnel. And he had, like, stuff, you know, drawn in the tunnel like it was a trip.
Can I make one observation?
Yeah.
Or offer a thought?
Yes, please.
We don't know that he wasn't.
Mm. That's true.
He was a genius.
He was a genius, so he could...
He could have been moments away.
Wouldn't that have been great?
Moments away from miniaturization.
If we just saw a scene where they were all in the living room and all of a sudden the train pulled up, it reaches the end and then it stops and it's on a circular, almost a Lazy Susan kind of thing, and it turns. And it would be funny if it turned and all of a sudden you saw... And Ed McMahon suddenly grew.
Wouldn't it be great if he figured out how to miniaturize his wife except for her hair? Except it would probably have crushed her. So that wouldn't have been so great.
Yeah, because I was going to say, you just see like the train come out of the tunnel. And there's just this huge hair sticking out the back.
Like Marge. Like a,
yeah.
When I heard Farnsworth, all I could think of was Futurama.
Yes.
Professor Farnsworth.
And I was hoping he was miniaturizing, but so the opening.
We don't know that he wasn't.
Yes, yes. And the shot starts on the train, and then the camera tracks over to the left, and it kind of tracks over to the far left of the room, so you can see the entire room. And it's one of those very tall mansion-y sets. Yeah.
Big staircase.
Yes, and sort of, it's really like the sort you'd seen a lot of like 30s, 40s murder mysteries. Like the walls just seem to go up forever and ever, and the room looked familiar too. I thought maybe I'd seen it in Columbo, but it's interesting because
it's in the Bronx, Bayside, I think.
Oh yes, yeah. And it's weird because the camera kind of sits there as Inspector Queen and the maid have a really long discussion, and about 30 seconds into the discussion, I thought, I wonder why we're not getting any closer. Anyone, you think you get some coverage here, and then Ellery and Veely enter, and then Ellery, and they're even further in the background, farther in the background, and then Ellery moves towards the train, and then the camera tracks back over right to where it started on the train with Ellery at it. And I thought it was an interesting shot because it foregrounds the fact that the train is the most important part of this room in relation to the mystery, or is it?
Did you have a train set growing up?
I did. We had a big Lionel train set.
I thought so.
We had a Lamont train set.
A miniaturization train set.
You know what? Another name people don't use a lot? Preston. There should be Preston. More Prestons.
That's a good name.
Yeah, it is a good name. We had a big Lionel train set, and it was on, and there were two trains on it. There was one that went around, it was a big rectangular table, one that went all the way around the perimeter, and then one that did it like a loop, number eight, in the center, yeah. And there were all sorts of little houses and bushes and not quite as elaborate as Ed McMahon's set, but it's freaking Ed McMahon, come on.
Yeah.
But it had the little cars on streets, and it had a crossing.
What?
And I think one of them had a spot. That I think that the inner one had a spot where it would, you could get it to stop at a house or something, and you would push on something, and like cows would shake their way out. You know, like those
vibrating football game things
where you would, you know, and you'd hit. And all the players would start vibrating, and these little cows would go out or into the car, and then it would go around. Oh, I used to play that for hours. Oh. And they had those great switches. There's one of the MSTs. I want to say it's Danger Death Ray. They have like these great, like strange shaped switches. Well, I don't want that, but I'll take two of those switches. And and every once in a while they let off a big spark, which is scary.
My follow up question is: have you ever pretended you were senile to spend some time away from me?
No, okay. I have not. True story. Okay. I have not
yet.
Yet, yeah. So, let me check my notes to see if I've got anything else. Do you have anything else on this one, Vic?
No, it's a fun one. You should watch it.
Yeah, let's see. The OMS. Our way. Yeah, I think that's about it. Yeah, it's a good episode. And the great thing is this is not spoiling. And you may hear this if I can get the clip later on. But there's a lovely moment right at the end when the mystery's been solved, and it's like 11:30 at night. And Ellery and Miss Farnsworth have a lovely moment together where they're going to go out and get a little late supper.
And listen to some soft music.
Yes, and what are they going to do?
Collaborate.
Oh boy, and it feels like it's like Dirty Ellery. He's very
the heart wants what it wants.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the adventure of the eccentric engineer. Thank you so much again for joining me, babe. And
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And actually, the funny thing about the Ellery bit you're going to hear right here is that he and Miss Farnsworth are in Inspector Queen's office. Ellery finds something, realizes who the killer is, and says to Miss Farnsworth, Lorelei, can you go wait in the car for a minute? And she goes, but Ellery, please just go wait in the car. You're wonderful. And gives her a big smile. And she goes, okay. And she goes to wait in the car. And you realize that he tells her to go wait in the car so he can sit at the desk and tell us.
Talk to us.
Yeah. So,
which makes me feel special.
I feel
when
special.
And I'm like, you sent away Anne Rankin to talk to me? Oh my God, I blushed.
Oh my God, she did. She really did.
I did.
But
oh, Jim Hutton. Here's and your son,
yes.
Tim Hutton. Oh, I'm fanning myself.
Yes.
With some sort of
junk mail.
Junk mail fanning.
So here's what he had to say to us.
Yes, Hillary. Well, I was just having my... You what?
I said I know who killed Lamont Franklin.
Well, that's wonderful, son. Have Billy make the arrest, and I'll see you later.
Dad, hold on. Please, don't hang up. Don't make an arrest. It just won't work.
Now, don't tell me. You want all of the suspects gathered together.
That's right, Dad. At the Franklin house.
But, son, it's just 9 o'clock. All right, Ellery. Yes, son. I'll see you at the Franklin house at 10 o'clock.
The Lone Ranger rides again.
Silver! We're heading west to the Pecos! Silver!
But, Ellery, I don't understand.
But there it is. A spindle, don't you see?
No, I don't see.
Oh, look, I'll explain on the way over. I had to call Sergeant Veely and get some things organized. Will you wait out in the car for me?
Well,
you're terrific. Well, there you have it. Who do you think killed Lamont Franklin? Was it his widow, Carol, or his brother-in-law, Doug Carmichael? How about Claude Sitwell, or Roger Woods, or his wife, Emily? How about Billy Geter, or was it someone else? Now, I'll tell you one thing. That wire spindle is very important. You got the message? Let's see.
And that, my friends, is episode 48. It's nice to be back on track. I look at those last four episodes where things went a little wonky with recording as sort of, I think I posted this somewhere, sort of like the wilderness years. So if you're listening to them live now as they're coming out, you may have been listening to them going, Dan, what's going on? But a year from now, 2 years from now, if someone else is just discovering this show, they're going to hear those four episodes and be like, oh, at some point this happened. You know, it'd be historical. It almost is historical. It'll be historical in a few episodes. But I'm so glad you folks are with us and enjoying it. It's a great time. I do hope you enjoyed the episode. Well, let's see. EventuallySuperTrain.blogspot.com is the website. At eSuperTrain1 on Twitter. EventuallySuperTrain on Facebook. eSuperTrain@yahoo.com. See what else is going on. I'm also on the Made for TV Mayhem show with my good podcast pal Amanda Reyes and the great Nathan Johnson. We're getting near the end. The Dan's Driving double feature spinoff, 1 Minute with Blood Lake and Ice. When you hear this, we'll almost be done, for heaven's sakes. Gosh, wow, okay. Yeah, and you know, I've got books out, the Bleeding Skull book, and you're going to hold on for the second book there for a moment. And what else is going on? Podcast Mania. That's about it for now. I'm just gonna wrap this up. I'm so used to the episodes of the last four running so short. This one's gone a little bit longer, so I want to wrap it up. And I'm actually gonna wrap it up with an ad for my second book. Enjoy the ad. Thank you, Kristen, for putting your voice on it. And thank you, Shannon, a.k.a. Rusting Willpower, for creating it. And buy the book. No. Yeah. Do it. Buy the book. Did I just say? I didn't mean to say no. I don't know where that came from. But yeah, here. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. See you next time.
Enter the world of Ho Lai, Reb Brown, and so many heroes named Steve.
80s Action Movies on the Cheap is filled with insightful reviews about the films made during the decade that gave us big hair, shoulder pads, and yuppies. This book is an excellent guide through the action movies that didn't quite make blockbuster status, or in some cases, any status at all. Written with wit, good humor, a definite fondness, and minimal spoilers, this book is a must-have for film lovers. 80s Action Movies on the Cheap by Daniel R. Budnick is available now at Amazon and McFarlane Books.